Today is Tuesday, September 21st, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden meets UN Chief as the United Nations General Assembly gets underway.
And the Secretary General and I share a strong commitment to the principles of human freedom and human dignity on which the UN was founded.
Plus, Islamic State insurgents step up attacks against the Taliban.
Islamic State affiliate in Afghanistan wants to convey to the Taliban that they are very much present in the country.
Also, Lebanon's critical fuel shortages are showing no signs of ending. Our top story today is in New York. The United Nations General Assembly formally gets underway Tuesday in New York. U.S. President Joe Biden met with U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Monday ahead of his first speech as president at the annual high-level gathering at the UN. Biden's visit comes amid turbulence in U.S. foreign policy with his chaotic exit from Afghanistan, a deal with Australia for nuclear-powered submarines that has alienated France, and worries about the world's recovery from COVID-19. Biden said a strong partnership with the UN was more important now than ever, and that no one country can solve key problems alone.
And the Secretary General and I share a strong commitment to the principles of human freedom and human dignity on which the UN was founded. I went back and reread the Charter. I remember, as we sometimes forget, what the founding principle, not you, but we, the world. Every UN member state, likewise, has an obligation to uphold those fundamental commitments and that we've all made. And normally the task is already ahead for each one of us, and it's real. But the vision of the United Nations has never been short in ambition, any more than our Constitution. But the ambition matters. Today, governments must continue to work together in a system built on international law to deliver equitable prosperity, peace, and security for everyone. And this is as valuable and necessary today as it was 76 years ago.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden. This week, New York will see one of its first large gatherings since the coronavirus pandemic, with more than 100 world leaders and their staff members returning to the United Nations for their annual meetings. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports.
It is a scaled-back version of the annual United Nations General Assembly. World leaders have the option of attending in person with a very small delegation or sending a video message. But there's no shortage of problems to discuss. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Our world is heading towards a new abnormal, more chaotic, more insecure, or dangerous for everyone. We are moving in the wrong direction, and we are at a pivotal moment.
South Korean boy band BTS kicked off the week, offering a message of hope for youth impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Guterres and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson convened a few dozen other leaders to discuss climate action ahead of a key climate conference in Scotland in November. They urged rich countries to do more to fund mitigation and adaptation efforts in developing nations. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
It is the developing world that is bearing the brunt of catastrophic climate change in the form of hurricanes and fires and floods and the real long-term economic damage that they face. And yet it's the developed world that over 200 years has put the carbon in the atmosphere that is causing this acceleration of climate change. And so it really is up to us to help them.
Halting the COVID-19 pandemic through global vaccination is the other urgent priority. The World Health Organization has set mid-2022 as its target for 70% of the world's population to be vaccinated. But poorer countries are not on track to reach this. On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden will convene a virtual meeting on ways to curb the spread of the virus. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
President Biden is committed to leading in concert with our allies and partners across the globe to stop the COVID-19 pandemic. We are building a coalition of governments, businesses, international institutions, and civil society to expand vaccine production, accelerate access to vaccines and life-saving treatment, and strengthen health systems around the globe.
But overshadowing these twin global crises is the latest geopolitical one, Afghanistan. Richard Gowan is the UN Director for International Crisis Group.
Afghanistan represents an enormous humanitarian challenge for the United Nations. And it's going to be UN agencies who are responsible for keeping Afghans alive during a period of hunger and political chaos.
G20 ministers meet Wednesday to discuss developments in Afghanistan. World leaders are also expected to address the issue during one-on-one talks. The Taliban's takeover is likely to figure prominently in Western leaders' speeches during the general debate, especially on the need to protect progress made on the rights of women and girls. Richard Gowan.
There's not very much the General Assembly can do to force the Taliban to protect those rights.
Starting Tuesday, leaders will address the General Assembly. One of the most anticipated statements will be from President Biden, who will address the General Assembly for the first time. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
President Biden will speak to our top priorities, ending the COVID-19 pandemic, combating climate change, the climate crisis, and defending human rights, democracy, and the international rules-based order. All three are challenges that stretch across borders. They involve every single country on earth.
With only a week to cover many pressing issues, leaders will have little time to enjoy New York City, which has begun to reopen its museums, restaurants, and Broadway theaters. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Ministers from Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia will meet with Iran at the United Nations later this week to try to give fresh momentum to stalled talks over reviving a 2015 nuclear deal, France's foreign minister said on Monday. A sixth round of indirect talks between Tehran and Washington was adjourned in June after hardliner Ebrahim Raisi was elected Iran's president and took office on August 5th. Since April, Iran and the world powers have tried to work out how Tehran and Washington can both return to compliance with the nuclear pact. Former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed harsh sanctions on Tehran. The meeting, which would include all the parties to the nuclear deal except for the United States, would aim to build some, quote, positive momentum, unquote, for negotiations to resume. The extremist Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for a series of deadly bombings targeting Taliban vehicles in eastern Afghanistan. The claim signals a growing threat to the Taliban by their longtime rivals. At least 8 people were killed in the attacks on Sunday and Saturday in the provincial city of Jalalabad. The attacks are raising fears that the Taliban government may not be able to contain the violence. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Girl in Islamabad.
These attacks suggest that Islamic State affiliate in Afghanistan, which is known as Islamic State Khorasan province, wants to convey to the Taliban that they are very much present in the country, and that is the security challenge that the Taliban will also have to deal with like their predecessors. When the American forces were present in Afghanistan, they supported the Afghan security forces at that time to really degrade the strength of Islamic State militants in that area. But now it was expected that with Taliban in control and the areas where Islamic State militants have been operating are where Taliban have a very strong influence, that there may be some reduction in violence and this group may go underground. But now this series of attacks, which primarily targeted Taliban fighters and their gatherings in Jalalabad, which is the capital city of Nangarhar province, that is definitely a challenge. And this is the question that was asked today at the press conference in Kabul from Taliban chief spokesman Zabiullah Mujahid. His response was quite interesting in a way that he claimed that they are capable of neutralizing the Islamic State threat and that these attacks, according to him, Afghans may not witness in near future, and these could be the last attacks, according to him, by this group.
What has been the reaction of Pakistan to this upsurge in attack on Islamic State?
That has been Pakistan's really a major concern in recent years, because this province of Afghanistan is on the Pakistani border, and from there, militants have also launched attacks inside Pakistan. So with Taliban in control, and Pakistan was hoping that the border areas will be secured by the Taliban, but obviously these attacks have worried authorities here in Pakistan. But when we spoke to them, they obviously are confident that there may be isolated attacks on this side of the border by Islamic State militants, but because Pakistan has recently erected a strong and robust fence across the entire border with Afghanistan, they're not expecting any major inflow of attacks on this side of the border.
The Taliban promised the world, at least the United States and NATO, that militant attacks will cease if they are unable to deal with Islamic State. Some fear the resurgence of Al-Qaeda.
This question was also asked today at the press conference from Zabiullah Mujahid, the spokesman of the Taliban, and his reply was interesting. And he said that whatever is being said about the presence of Al-Qaeda is merely a propaganda, and that no Al-Qaeda elements exist in Afghanistan, according to him, and that they are strictly adhering to the commitment they have given to the United States that no militant group, be it Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, will be allowed to use the Afghan soil against any country.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gaur speaking with me from Islamabad. Aid organizations say internal documents and witness accounts reveal the first starvation deaths since Ethiopia's government in June imposed what the UN calls, quote, a de facto humanitarian aid blockade, unquote, in the Tigray region. AP correspondent Kara Ana reports that sources the AP has talked to say many people are starving to death.
The war in Ethiopia's Tigray region has gone on for about 10 months. Now, what is new is that we have spoken to witnesses, we've obtained internal documents that show people have begun dying of starvation, starving to death since late June, which is when the Tigray forces retook most of the Tigray region.
Ethiopia's prime minister and other senior officials have denied there is hunger in Tigray. The government blames the Tigray forces and insecurity for troubles with aid delivery, and says it has reduced the number of checkpoints that slowed convoys. It also has accused humanitarian groups of supporting the Tigray fighters. U.S. authorities have closed the port of entry at Del Rio, Texas, where more than 12,000 Haitians have arrived seeking asylum. The Biden administration is flying them out in what may be the fastest large-scale expulsion of migrants in U.S. history. Dina Mitchell reports.
This U.S.-Mexico entry port in Del Rio, Texas, remained closed Monday as more than 12,000 mainly Haitian migrants continued to gather on U.S. soil under the Del Rio International Bridge, waiting to be taken into custody. John Anfinson is the local president for the Border Patrol Union Del Rio sector.
Yesterday it was in the 14,000s, and since DPS showed up and they've been able to block off some of the landings at the river, we've dropped to like 12,000 or so.
For days, U.S. authorities have worked to move the migrants out from under the bridge and out of the heat to processing facilities, where authorities determine who can apply for asylum and who will be flown back to Haiti. Many of the Haitians who made it here say they have been living in Brazil and Chile, some since the 2010 Haiti earthquake. They took the long trek to the U.S., encouraged by word of mouth that now was an ideal time to try to cross the border. One man said he had spent the past several months in Mexico on the Guatemalan border, kept there by the Mexican government.
It's very difficult for me. For example, I spent 2 months without work, without doing nothing for it.
In recent weeks, the bridge has become a holding place for migrants crossing the Rio Grande, while Border Patrol agents struggled to manage the massive influx. John Anfinson with the Border Patrol.
Border Patrol agents in Del Rio sector have not been able to patrol in the field properly for several months now because we're all indoors taking care of processing, taking care of kids that are in our custody.
Some local residents say the sheer number of migrants makes them nervous. Resident Peggy Duran.
When you have upwards of 20,000 people underneath the bridge, and people start getting restless, and when you're talking about a community of 45,000, that's half the population of this town.
Gwelen Yosef with the Haitian Bridge Alliance, a migrant advocacy group, says the Haitians are following the law.
One thing I'm hearing a lot of people saying, oh, they are coming here illegally. No. The legal thing for them to do is to come and ask for asylum. And that's what they are doing. But what's happening is that the United States is refusing to provide them access to get that protection.
The U.S. has flown out more than 3,000 Haitian migrants and has scheduled more flights in coming days in what some are calling the fastest large-scale expulsion of migrants in U.S. history. But Haiti, with its recent earthquake and political turmoil, isn't able to handle the returned citizens, says migrant advocates. For Haitian migrants, making it to Texas only to be deported has been devastating.
The trip to get to the U.S. was tough. They deported us. Unfortunately, they didn't let us take any of our belongings. It was like being in jail. No food, nothing.
Those who are returned to Haiti are given $100. Their dream to live and work in the United States, seemingly over. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Del Rio, Texas.
This is the Voice of America. Sudanese authorities have reported a coup attempt by a group of soldiers, but said the attempt failed and the transitional government remains in control. Sudan state-run television called on the public, quote, to counter, unquote, the attempt, but give few details. A member of the ruling military civilian council wrote on Facebook that, quote, all is under control, unquote, and called on the Sudanese to protect the transition. A military official said troops from the armored corps were behind the attempt and that they tried to take over several government institutions but were stopped. He said many troops, including high-ranking officials, have been arrested. British police said they are charging a third Russian suspect in a 2018 nerve agent attack on a former Russian agent in England. Scotland Yard said Tuesday that prosecutors believe there is sufficient evidence to charge a man known as Sergei Fedotov with conspiracy to murder, attempted murder, possession and using a chemical weapon, and causing grievous bodily harm. Former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia were targeted in a nerve agent attack in 2018 in Salisbury, England, that British authorities said had almost certainly been approved at a senior level of the Russian state-owned court. Moscow has vehemently denied the allegations. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Tuesday acknowledged he will need to work with other parties after he fell short of winning a majority in Monday's parliamentary elections. Flora Bradley-Watson of Reuters reports.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau won a third term on Monday, but his party fell short of a majority. Trudeau, in power since 2015 and governing with a minority of seats since 2019, had hoped to capitalize on his government's handling of the pandemic by calling an early vote. Instead, he was met by an unexpectedly tight race. His lackluster campaign was acerbated by voter anger at the decision to call an election during a health crisis, a point Trudeau acknowledged in his speech to supporters in Montreal.
I hear you when you say that you just want to get back to the things you love, not worry about this pandemic or about an election, that you just want to know that your members of Parliament of all stripes will have your back through this crisis and beyond.
CBC and CTV projected that Trudeau's Liberal government would hold a minority of seats in the House of Commons. Elections Canada showed the Liberals leading in 156 electoral districts nationally, one more than they held before the vote, leading one commentator to dub it a Groundhog Day election. The Conservatives, led by Erin O'Toole, were in second place and conceded defeat as results trickled in late into the night. A second minority government will mean Trudeau's Liberals will have to rely again on opposition parties, such as the left-leaning New Democratic Party, to pass legislation. Trudeau has pledged to work with other parties to get the country through the pandemic. He said the results meant he had a clear mandate and that brighter days were ahead.
That's Flora Bradley-Watson of Reuters. Germany is preparing to elect a new leader in elections scheduled September 26th as incumbent Chancellor Angela Merkel's 16 years in power come to an end. As Henry Ridgewell reports from Berlin, her successor will face a series of immediate geopolitical challenges from the rise of China to balancing transatlantic relations.
Hamburg, Germany's biggest port, handles more than 8.5 million containers every year. Almost a third are shipped to and from China, four times more than second-placed the United States. And Beijing has its eyes on this critical part of Germany's infrastructure. Chinese state-owned shipping firm COSCO wants to buy a third of the shares in the container port. The port's owners and the mayor support the deal, saying it's vital for Hamburg's growth. But critics say Germany should be wary. Jürgen Hart is a lawmaker with the ruling Christian Democrats Party.
In China, business plans are not mainly the reason to do business, but political decisions of the Communist Party. Therefore, we should look very carefully on that such a deal. I would prefer to have a change of shares between Hamburg Harbour and maybe Shanghai Harbour.
But China does not allow foreign companies to own its infrastructure. Germany's geopolitical dilemma echoes that of Hamburg. Is China friend or foe? In recent years, tensions have grown over Beijing's treatment of its Muslim Uyghur population, the crackdown on democratic rights in Hong Kong, and military expansion in the South China Sea. Germany has found itself caught in the middle, says analyst Liana Fix.
Europe and the European Union is undecided about which way to pursue. On the one side, they feel the pressure from the United States. On the other hand, there are also economic interests, especially for member states that are highly dependent on trade with China.
Germany's leadership could be out of step with the population, according to a recent poll, says analyst Liana Fix of the Körber Stiftung Foundation of International Affairs in Berlin.
We asked the German public to what extent they would support sanctions towards China, even if it hurts their economy, for human rights issues, for human rights violations. And there the majority of Germans said they would support sanctions against China.
With Russia too, Germany finds itself caught between East and West. Despite Russia's 2014 invasion of Ukraine, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has pushed ahead with the construction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which was completed this month. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Berlin.
Lebanon's critical fuel shortages are showing no signs of ending despite the arrival of Iranian oil smuggled into the country through neighboring Syria. Hezbollah has been arranging the informal oil imports, and prominent political and religious leaders are urging the new government to crack down on the smuggling, but Prime Minister Najib Mukhadi denies the government is involved. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Even Lebanon's parliament has been hit by the rampant power outages. Monday's session to discuss the new government's policies was delayed by an hour because of a power cut, but many Lebanese suffer round-the-clock blackouts while others wait for hours in long lines outside of gasoline stations, some of them lucky to get a quarter of a tank of gas. Iran-backed Hezbollah has made much fanfare of its initial delivery of Iranian oil into Lebanon last week, portraying itself as the country's savior, stepping in to resolve the acute energy crisis. This latest event gives yet another confirmation that Hezbollah has considerably increased its sway over the Lebanese state. Political scientist Karim Emil Bitar told AFP, "It is no longer even trying to hide behind the veneer of legality offered by official institutions," he said. The shipping monitor TankerTrackers.com has reported that a third Iranian tanker is on its way. Meanwhile, Iraqi fuel is being unloaded in southern Lebanon, according to the National News Agency. Prime Minister Najib Mukhadi denies the government officially approved the oil delivery, but it certainly has not stopped it. The tankers entered Lebanon from an illegal crossing point from Syria for a transaction that threatens violation of U.S. and other sanctions. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that Mukhadi, Hezbollah, and Syria have close connections.
This is another government born out of Hezbollah's agenda, and Mukhadi, who has very strong ties with the Syrian regime, is essentially a businessman from the city of Tripoli, where he has behaved like a classic feudal lord. This is exactly what's being done for the entire Lebanese population, keeping everybody on a shoestring with the absolute daily basics very scarce or absent, and then essentially throwing people a bone here or a bone there. Lebanon is still very far from being out of the woods.
Influential Maronite Catholic Patriarch Bashira Boutros al-Rahi denounced the smuggling of Iranian fuel from Syria in his Sunday sermon, saying the state cannot be built on practices or positions that contradict its entity and institutions. Al-Rahi said the new government should work as a united national team to stop the collapse and confront the continuous attack attempts against the state and its democratic system.
Observers point out that neither the arrival of Iraqi fuel to Lebanon's state electricity company nor that of Iranian diesel have so far yielded positive results, as the country continues to struggle to keep the lights on. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Powell-Dawson, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.